The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
And now, Sports Talk 1240.
Good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome to Hour 1 of Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB Freeport, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue taking you through the first hour on this Sunday night, the 12th of October, after which I'll hand it off to Andrew Joseph for Hour 2. Our engineer Brian Graves is across the way. We've got some great guests lined up for you tonight. Up first, we'll welcome in author and former Penn State quarterbacks coach Jay Paterno. We'll be discussing his book, Paterno Legacy. Up next, we hope to talk to former NFL great wide receiver Tim Brown about his new book, The Making of a Man. Finally, we'll speak to a friend of the show, NHL star and former Ranger Bernie Nichols, about the NHL picture out of the gate and about his new sports app. So we've got a full plate tonight. As always, before we begin, I invite you to follow us on our Facebook page, Sports Talk 1240, where you'll find sports and information, show information, and more. So stop by, give us a look, and more importantly, give us a like. You can also follow us on Twitter at Sports Talk 1240, and all past shows can be heard on our website at www.sportstalk1240.com. Well, my first guest spent more than two decades coaching college football, including 17 seasons at Penn State after coaching stops at the University of Virginia and the University of Connecticut, as well as James Madison University. At Penn State, he coached three all-Big Ten quarterbacks and two Big Ten MVPs. He helped orchestrate some of the most successful offenses in Penn State and Big Ten conference history. He has gone on to become a prolific writer for various publications, and especially now with the release of his new book, Paterno Legacy. I welcome to the show Jay Paterno. Jay, welcome aboard.
Good to be here.
Great to have you. Now, in Chapter 1, you get right into it. Let's talk about it, the elephant in the room and the free report.
Yeah, well, you know, I felt like what I wanted to do with this book, because I wanted the book to be, what I didn't want to do is write a Sandusky scandal book.
Right.
And that's not what this is.
That's been done ad nauseum. Some of my more well-known colleagues in Manhattan, and we know who they are, have rehashed again the Sandusky situation, and we want to talk about the book tonight.
Yeah, and I just felt like I wanted to hit it head on so that, you know, the readers that came to the book and have that kind of in the back of their mind can get the facts of that situation, get that off the deck,
right,
and then really appreciate Joe's life for what it was.
Definitely. Talk a little bit about that report, though, and fill some people in on it who may not be familiar with the report, Jay.
Well, the report was commissioned by the Board of Trustees of Penn State and written by Louis Freeh's group. Louis Freeh being the former head of the FBI, and I stress former because I think a lot of people, when they heard about the report, read it, whatever, had the assumption that this was an FBI report, and it's not the case.
Right.
And I think it's important for people to know that Louis Freeh did not have subpoena power. He did not interview the key people in this case, and he drew a lot of conclusions that were just simply not supported by the facts. And that's, so I go at it and poke a lot of holes in it and show people what the facts of the case are. And not, these aren't my opinions. These are facts, you know, and the prosecutor, and I even talk about the prosecutors in the entire Sandusky case, who have stated repeatedly that as it relates to my dad, and I don't know everybody else's situation, but as it relates to Joe Paterno, that he was honest, cooperative, forthcoming, he reported the crime, and he in no way tried to conceal or cover up a crime.
Definitely.
As far as my dad's situation goes, that's it. End of story.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, as you said, this book talks about Joe the man, and Joe your dad, Joe the coach, etc. Let's talk about Joe at home.
Well, you know, he was like a lot of other dads. I mean, there were things he was really good at, and things he was really inept at. And I talk about all those things. And, you know, I talk about times where you know, I got in trouble in school or I did something, you know, how he handled that at home, lessons he taught us at home, what family dinners were like. You know, our family dinners always ended with, it would be 15, 20, 30 minutes of just arguing about anything, you know, politics or current events or whatever. But it was always an attempt to educate, always an attempt to help us see other sides of things. And I was fortunate because it gave me really kind of a real strong ability to see any particular issue from a number of different perspectives, because he would force us to argue sides of things that maybe we didn't even want to argue. And he'd say, well, suppose you were in favor of this, how would you argue? So, I mean, it was really a fascinating, in a great house to grow up in.
Get you to think a little bit.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, we're speaking to Jay Paterno tonight. The book is called Paternal Legacy. One chapter I enjoyed is called It's Got to Be the Shoes.
Are you a Yankee fan, I'm guessing?
No.
Okay. Well, you know, for years, every time Penn State went out, we had black shoes.
Right.
And they were always polished up on Thursday after practice, because we didn't practice on Friday, so the game shoes were always polished. And it went back to a World Series game my dad had been at in the 1940s with the Cardinals and the Yankees. And
right.
His high school coach took them and he said, look at the Cardinals' uniforms, and they were rank gold, and the shoes were scuffed. And he said, look at the Yankees, and they were perfectly pressed, and the shoes were just perfectly shined, and the sun was, back when he used to play World Series games in the afternoon, the sun was just hitting off them, and he said, they just looked like such professionals. And he said, they won the World Series that year, and he said, I just got hooked on that idea of what Yankee tradition was. And he carried it all the way through. For the time he was done coaching, and even in 2011, our guys at Penn State had, there were no names in our jerseys, very plain uniforms, but always immaculate. And our guys had to cut their hair, they had to shave, they couldn't have earrings on, very similar to what the Yankees continue to have at this point. And I always thought that was kind of a neat thing.
Exactly, yeah. The way you brought it out was great, too, looking at the corporate way. One thing I didn't enjoy, Jay, was the reference to Stanley O'Neill. I used to work for Merrill Lynch.
Oh.
And, yeah.
Yeah, I know his tenure didn't end very well.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
No, I got laid off during his era, yeah. What you didn't mention is he brought the company to its knees. But, yeah, he didn't have dreadlocks. That's one thing.
Absolutely. And that was the point he was making these guys, because you got to understand, this is the way the world is, and the world's going to judge you based on appearance. And he said, it's not fair, but it's reality, and if I don't prepare you for what's really going to hit you when you get out of here, then I'm not doing my job. You don't see that a lot anymore in college football. It's not about preparing kids for what the world's going to be like when they get out and they're not playing football anymore.
No, they pretty much go their own way, and he really believed in in academics, in academia, and also in a Penn State tradition, didn't he?
Oh, absolutely. And, there were times, there were times when we would, one of my first months back at Penn State, I mean, he was asking about a kid who had finished playing and had been in the NFL for 2 years and was 6 credits away from graduating. And he said, let's get him, how are we going to get him back here to get that degree? And the guy was still playing in the NFL. He's still active. But he said, you only need 6 credits. There's no sense in him getting that close and not getting his degree. And that was a guy who wasn't playing for him anymore.
Right.
But he was that way. His focus was, and he said, look, first and foremost, football's going to end for all these guys someday. I don't care how good they are. They better have we want them to get a meaningful education at a great institution. That's the first priority of college football. And you look around college football now, we could use a breath of that, because every discussion that we have now involves paying players, coaches making $4.5 million a year, conferences being, formed really for television contracts and billions of dollars and that kind of stuff. So it was really a unique student-athlete-centered program, and it was always that way. And when I say student-athlete-centered, I don't mean the inmates were in the asylum. I mean, student-athlete center in terms of what was in their welfare.
Right.
In terms of they were going to get a degree first before they were worried about being great football players.
Definitely. Now, what people may not realize is that Joe was part of the campus. He basically was part of campus life. When he was done at work, he walked home.
His house was still, my mom still lives in the same house, but we grew up four blocks from campus, and he would walk to school, and walk to the office, which was 15 minutes. Now, when he got older, he drove more often, but when the weather was good, he'd walk, and he'd walk through campus, and he'd see students, and students would stop him, and, he would talk to them, and he was involved in a lot of other academic things. So he and my mom helped the university raise hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, mostly for academics, not for athletics. Endowed scholarships, built buildings. The library has their name on it because they raised so much money for it. And mm-hmm. He would always remind us as coaches that we're here to serve the university, not the other way around. And we're a part of this university, and football's a part of life, not life itself. So he had his priorities in the right order.
Now, did you take those walks home with him, Jay?
After games, yeah, we would walk home after games. When I first got back, we'd walk from the stadium, and then it got to the point where people would be waiting outside the stadium, so they would put us in the truck and drive us about two or three blocks, and then we'd walk the last 15 minutes home or so from there. And it was great because, when you're one of five kids, as I am, it was not always easy to get that kind of one-on-one time with your father, especially during football season.
Yeah.
So, when I got back coaching, we'd walk home together. I'd park my car at their house, and we'd walk home together, and we'd talk about the game. We'd talk about, whatever happened to come up, or he'd ask about my kids, that kind of stuff. And those are moments that I'm so glad I have, and I wouldn't trade them for anything in the world.
Nice, yeah. Immortal moments.
Yep.
Now, what about the Zen of Joe Paterno?
Well,
that's a great way to put it.
Well, the funny thing is that chapter came from a discussion I had with a friend of mine, and he was talking about, he had read some things about Zen Buddhism and things like that, and being in the moment, and the conversation, I was in a conversation about the blue line at our practice, and there's a blue line when you would walk out of our locker room, and on the practice field, there's a blue line, and he would say, when you cross that blue line, you can't do anything about anything's going on at home, or your girlfriend, or the test you just failed. You have to be all focused in on what we're doing here on the practice field. You can't do any better anything else. And he said, you got to be here. And it made sense. But he said, but that's on the other hand, when you go into a math class or a history class, or you got to have a blue line, and when you cross that into that classroom, you can't do anything about football.
Right.
And then as I got older, he would say, Jay, when you go home, be home. I said, well, I am. He goes, no. I mean, you have to physically be there as well as mentally be there. You have to be both so that your kids, when you're around, you can't be thinking about what you can do on Saturday on 3rd and 15. You got to be locked in, dialed in, and be there. So he said, that my friend said the blue line thing is a totally Zen concept. He said it's unbelievable. So then I started to look at all these other things my dad was teaching and put them all in that chapter, and those are really the core lessons of what he was all about.
So Joe Paterno was really Phil Jackson, is what you're saying.
Before Phil Jackson was Phil Jackson. Well, what's funny is Phil Jackson's daughter actually played volleyball at Penn State.
No way!
And so they did a joke, as Nancy Sports Illustrated did an article where I talked about Blue Line. This is in 2009, and I said, Phil Jackson says, surrender the knee for the we, and Joe would talk about we want we and us people. And I said that, talk about the Blue Line. I said, Joe's not going to say be in the moment. But there was the blue line, and there was a lot of similarities. So it was kind of funny because when the article came out, I had sent, she saw it and sent me a message, emailed me, and we kind of went back and forth. That was kind of funny.
That's a great story, Jay. We're speaking to Jay Paterno tonight about his book, Paterno Legacy. What about the retirement?
Well, you know, he had planned to retire before 2011 season. And he and actually the president of the university and the AD had discussed a couple of names, people to succeed him. And they had kind of put together a plan in place of how this would happen. And so, you know, he didn't want to announce before the season because he didn't want a farewell tour and all that kind of stuff. So when the story broke in November, as it related to Sandusky in November of 11, he said, you know, there's a lot of discussion about what's going to happen. So look, I'll just clear the decks and say I'm going to retire and announce it to get it over with. And that was in, you know, early November. And then the university, the board of trustees, without consulting anybody, without talking to anybody, without talking to Joe at all, basically announced they're going to fire him. And that was, you know, it's unfortunate because, you know, at the end of the day, you know, it was only, we only had 3-4 more games left to go. And it's unfortunate that there wasn't any respect from some of the people on the board of trustees, you know, because the story broke on a Friday, they fired him on Wednesday night, and not one time did any of them pick up the phone and talk to him. Not one time did any of them consult with him or say, hey, yeah, what's the best way forward out of this, that kind of stuff. So basically he was fired for reporting a crime, and it's, you know.
So do you think, Jay, they did that to save face with the public, that they got Joe before Joe got them?
I think what it was is they just, you know, it was a panic mode, and I'm not sure, you know, what their motives were. One thing I don't get into in the book is what their motives were because I wasn't in the room, and I don't want to assign motives where I don't know motives.
Right.
You know, but I think it was definitely a CYA act where, you know, the media was all over campus and all over Penn State, and they figured, you know, if we fire Joe, they'll go away. And it turned out that was not the case. They stuck around longer because it led the implication that there was more there than people knew, and there must really be something big here.
Definitely. What a story that is, right?
Right, absolutely. And, you know, when you look at the way Syracuse handled it, everybody forgets that, you know, Jim Boeheim's assistant, Bertie Fine, was accused of the same kind of crimes. And, you know, the university backed Jim Boeheim. He got to stay, you know, he stood up and addressed it. And Bertie Fine was removed from the program, and Syracuse moved on as though nothing had ever happened there.
Definitely.
And I think this would have ended much differently if they had simply worked together with Joe and stood behind him, because, again, you know, this is not a guy that committed a crime. I mean, this is a guy that reported a crime that he himself didn't even witness. He was given a report of something. And then went and, you know, he knew, he followed the university policy because he said this is the way this is supposed to be handled. And he got fired for it. So I think that's a chilling message to send people that are teachers, nurses, doctors, even middle management and companies that get reports of this and they look at this and say, look what happened to Joe Paterno. I'm just going to put my head down. I didn't hear anything.
Exactly.
You know, that's the worst message we can send out of this entire story.
Now, he had to be absolutely devastated by this.
Absolutely. He, you know, this is not something, you know, people say, how could he not know? Well, you know, here's the thing. You know, these are crimes that are very, very hard to detect by people that are as good as Jerry Sandusky was at doing this, concealing it, number one. Number two, we weren't in elementary education. I mean, we were dealing with 18 to 22, 23, 24-year-old kids. So we weren't dealing with underage kids where you would have a sexual abuse situation as it relates to children. So we weren't trained in this. So we wouldn't be able to recognize it anyway. And on that top of that, the first time he received a report of it, Jerry wasn't even his employee anymore. Jerry had been retired for a couple of years. And Jerry was actually working for the Second Mile, which is the charity he founded. So there were a lot of, he was stunned. I mean, at the time, you know, everybody knows now, you know, we didn't know in 2001 what we know now after a trial and all these victims coming forward. In 2001, Jerry Sandusky was considered a pillar of the community. He was a non-drinking, church-going, married, you know, retired football coach at that time who had served a statewide charity to benefit young people all over the state. So everything about him would lead you, and I knew my whole life, I was floored, absolutely stunned by all this.
Unbelievable. Now, how did you deal with the loss of your dad?
Well, writing his book was probably the best way I did it because, you know, my dad died on a Sunday morning, and the night before, you know, a student student, a website, had reported he was dead. Mm-hmm. And then CBS Sports picked it up and ran with it and became a story on Saturday night. And, you know, you're in your dad's hospital room, and you know he's probably down his last couple of days, and you got to, you know, I had to leave the room and go put something on social media that he was still alive.
Right.
And then the next morning when he died, you know, 10 minutes after my dad died, maybe not even that long, we're in a room across the hall, my brothers and I and some people that were with us, and okay, we got to get Mom out of here. She's got to go out the back door because, you know, there's media out front of the hospital before we announce anything. So we had to get my mom out of there, then we had to announce, you know, then we announced my dad has died, and then we got to worry about getting him to the funeral home. So, you know, getting to the funeral home without somebody snapping pictures of it, because you want to, you know, didn't want my grandkids to, you know, Google my dad's name and find somebody at a hospital taking a selfie with, you know, I mean, I don't mean to be,
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
I mean, but that's the world we live in now.
Exactly.
And,
yeah,
you know, so those things. And then, you know, 2 days later, you have a public viewing and 50,000 people line up. And I was there for most of that, from all day Tuesday and into Wednesday morning. And then we had a funeral, and then Thursday with a public memorial service. And then, you know, and you're doing interviews and things on Tuesday morning, and there's all these things going on that have nothing to do with actually coming to grips with the fact that your dad died. And it's a very public morning, and, it, you know, until I really sat down and started to really hammer out some of these stories that are in this book, you know, I was finally, like, alone in a room thinking about my dad and what I'd lost. And it really helped me. I mean, there were times I was writing stories crying, times I was laughing out loud, and my wife thought I was cracking up. And I would come in, I'd tell her a story, and she'd laugh. But, you know, once I was done with it, I just felt really good about it, felt really proud of it, and felt like I had done as good a job as I can do for a guy that, you know, it was a great story to tell. It was a great subject to write about.
So it was good therapy for you, Jay.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I think, you know, I've heard a lot of feedback from a lot of people who've read it, who were Penn State alums, not even, you know, maybe never even met my dad, but, you know, or even just people that felt like they could learn something from him. And, you know, they said, you know, you shared your dad's life with us. You shared your dad with us all your life. And it really means a lot to us that you would share even more of it even after he's gone. Because, you know, as you know, it takes you into meeting rooms. It takes you into family dinners. It takes you into locker rooms before big games. It takes you into team meetings where he's giving them the lecture. You know, I mean, how many college football coaches are going to talk about Shakespeare, read Shakespeare to their team when they're struggling? Not a whole lot.
No.
But that's what he did, and that's what made him unique, and you never knew what you were going to get from him in those things. So people felt, I felt very fortunate to be able to share that with people, having been there in the first person, you know, having witnessed these things myself.
Well, it shows you, too, Jay, the respect you got from peers, from Urban Meyer, from people like Mike Krzyzewski, from other coaches around the country as well.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's one of those things that I've heard from a lot of guys, and you know, and one of the things they always said, you know, when you recruited against Joe, you knew he wasn't going to cheat. When you played against him, you knew he was playing with guys that belonged in the school, and that he wasn't cutting corners and cheating and those kind of things. And I think in a world that's as competitive as college, big-time college football, that may be as good a tribute as you can give anybody, is that when you lined up to play Penn State, you knew they were going to play hard, you knew they were going to play tough and smart, but you also knew they were doing things the right way. And you know, when people you play against and compete against have that kind of respect for you, it says a lot about the character of your program, of your person.
So in a nutshell, Jay, the paternal legacy, what is it?
Well, I think what it is, it's the people he impacted, the lessons he gave to so many, and that we endure, and that the lessons endure, and the people that he really impacted in such positive ways, I think would be the legacy. And I think one of the things that, you know, people said, what do you want people to get out of this book? And I think what I've said, you know, to a lot of people is, look, what I want people to understand about my dad and how he's gone is that, you know, coaching football did not define him. It's what he did. And it was the medium by which he chose to paint the masterpieces of his life. And those are the lives he impacted, lessons he left to so many people, and he was an educator first and a coach second. And I think that's really what the legacy of his life will be. It will be those lessons and those masterpieces he's created in productive lives of great people that have learned from him.
Outstanding. Well, Jay Paterno, we thank you for taking time out of your Sunday night to talk to us about your dad. The book is called Paterno Legacy. It's available at Amazon. It's from our friends out in Chicago at Triumph. Jay, again, thank you. It was great having you with us.
Thanks. Great to be on. I really appreciate it, and I hope people get the book and really enjoy it.
Thanks again. Jay Paterno, ladies and gentlemen. Next up, we'll be back. We hope to bring you Tim Brown. I'm not sure he's going to be with us, but we'll be back nonetheless. So you stay with us, folks.
Radio New York and AM 1240 WGBB are proud to announce the new Sports Talk 1240, along with the launch of a brand new website at sportstalk1240.com. Check out our new site for information about upcoming shows, as well as easy access to past shows, articles, our live studio webcam, and more. Of course, be sure to tune in to Sports Talk 1240 every Sunday night from 8 to 10 p.m. on AM 1240 WGBB. Or visit sportstalk1240.com for ways to listen to the live broadcast online or from your iPhone. We're excited about these new changes and hope you will be too.
So you're looking for a great club but don't want to go into Manhattan, or you'd like to find a new restaurant to check out, or you're buying a house here on Long Island and you'd like to find out about a certain area. Wouldn't it be nice if you can find out all the information in just one spot? Well, you can. LongIslandExchange.com. It's all you need to find out all about Long Island. LongIslandExchange.com for hotspots, classifieds, news, and more. LongIslandExchange.com is designed with only the Long Islander in mind. Get the best of Long Island. LongIslandExchange.com. Discover Long Island all over again at LongIslandExchange.com.
If you're trying to quit smoking, dipping, or chewing tobacco, you don't have to do it alone. Nicotine Anonymous is a 12-step program of recovery that meets regularly in your area. There are no dues or fees. The only requirement for membership is a desire to be free of nicotine. For information and meetings near you, call 877-TRY-NIC-A. That's 877-TRY-NICA. Or visit nicotine-anonymous.org. Let us share our experience, strength, and hope with you.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240. Check us out every Sunday night at 8 p.m. right here on AM 1240 WGBB. And visit us online at sportstalk1240.com.
Making simple changes in your everyday travel choices makes a big difference to New York's air quality. Trip chain, use mass transit, rideshare, bike, or walk. Visit cleanairny.org to learn more. Clean Air New York, breathe it in. A public service message brought to you by the New York State Department of Transportation.
And now, back to Sports Talk 1240.
All right, we're back with Sports Talk 1240 WGBB Freeport, New York. Bill Donahue with you on this beautiful autumnal Sunday evening in October. Pretty nice day today. Hope it was nice where you are. Tim Brown will not be with us tonight. I'm very, very, very sorry to alert you to that fact. Not able to get in touch with the young man, the nine-time Pro Bowl selection and Heisman Trophy winner for the Fighting Irish in Notre Dame. Had a problem with his publisher all week. We'll try to get back to her during the week and find out what the problem was. But in the meantime, did you ever wonder what's in a nickname? I know I have. Brian probably has, too. How about the NHL nicknames? Did you ever wonder where they come from? I'm sure you have. Let's take a look at where some of them came from. Let's talk about the New York Rangers. Well, in 1925, the New York Americans joined the National Hockey League. They played their home games at the old Madison Square Garden. A gentleman by the name of Tex Rickard, the boxing promoter and ex-gold prospector, he built and owned the arena. He decided he wanted to own his own NHL team, which he was awarded in 1926. Now, Rickard's team was immediately dubbed Texas Rangers. as a pun referencing the paramilitary force founded in Texas during the 1830s. Now, the Americans folded in 1942, while Texas Rangers remain. So that's where the name Rangers came from. There you go, fans of the Broadway Blue Shirts. Put that in your pipe and smoke it. Now, we're going to cross the Hudson River, go over to Jersey, and find out how those devils got their nickname. Well, given that New Jersey has never been known for its mountains, the team needed a new nickname after the Colorado Rockies relocated to the Garden State in 1982. The New Jersey Sports and Exhibition Authority sponsored a statewide newspaper contest to determine the new nickname, and some of the other finalists included Americans, Blades, Coastals, Colonials, Gulls, Jaguars, Meadowlanders, and Meadowlarks. While some fans objected to the winning selection on religious grounds, one threatened the life of a reporter who was covering the search, the devil has an entirely non-religious folk history in New Jersey. According to legend, a harmless creature known as the Leeds Devil or the Jersey Devil roamed the Pine Barrens in the southern part of the state from 1887 until 1938. I wonder where he went. 1938 till now. Where's he been? Jeez. Let's go to the next team. We'll head a few miles to the west here and look at those New York Islanders. When New York's expansion Major League Baseball franchise held a Name the Team contest in 1961, that's the Mets, Islanders finished third behind Mets and Empires. 11 years later, Islanders was selected as the nickname for New York's new hockey team, which plays its home game on Long Island for now, until they move to Brooklyn next year. The Philadelphia Flyers, the team sponsored a Name the Team contest after Ed Snyder, then vice president of the Philadelphia Eagles, brought hockey back to the city of brotherly love in 1966. Snyder's sister, Phyllis, you know Phyllis, reportedly suggested the name Flyers, which sounds good when paired with Philadelphia, but it doesn't have any real meaning. So there you go. So Phyllis Snyder came up with that name, and it doesn't have any real meaning. So they think they're all tough down there and everything, but Phyllis Snyder came up with the name, and it doesn't mean anything. Big deal. The Pittsburgh Penguins. The Pittsburgh Post-Gazette sponsored a Name the Team contest, but Carol McGregor, we all know her as well, the wife of one of the franchise's part owners, Jack McGregor, was one of the she was responsible for the nickname. Another nobody. In his book, The Pittsburgh Penguins, The Official History of the First 30 Years, Bob Grove describes how Carol McGregor came up with the name. I was thinking of something with a P, and I said to Jack, what do they call the Civic Arena? And he said, the Big Igloo. So I thought, ice, Pittsburgh, Penguins. Woo-hoo! More than 700 of the 26,000 contest entries were for Penguins. There we go, folks. Carol McGregor, that minx, she came up with Penguins. Let's move up to Beantown now and Boston Bruins. When grocery store tycoon Charles Adams brought a team to Boston, he hired former hockey great Art Ross, he of the Art Ross Trophy, to serve as his general manager. Adams tasked Ross with coming up with a nickname, with one of the requirements being that the team's colors would be the same as his grocery store chain's, brown and yellow. So Ross decided on Bruins. Oh, man. Yeah, I hear you. Let's move up to Beefalo. When Buffalo entered the league in 1970, owners Seymour Knox III and Northrop Knox wanted the nickname for their new team to be unique. The brothers sponsored a Name the Team contest, good idea, and decided on Sabres, with the Buffalo featured prominently in the team's logo. Okay. Moving up to Montreal. In 1909, John Ambrose O'Brien created the Club des Hockey Canadiens. Ambrose wanted his team, a charter member of the National Hockey Association, to appeal to Montreal's Francophone population. I guess French. And he hoped to drum up a rivalry with the city's established team, the Wanderers. The Canadiens are often referred to as the Habs, or Les Habs, an abbreviation of Les Habitants, the name for the early settlers of New France. The Ottawa Senators, the original Ottawa Senators, founded in 1883, won 11 Stanley Cups. When an NHL team returned to Ottawa in 1992 after a nearly 60-year hiatus, the nickname, a reference to Ottawa's status as Canada's capital city, was an obvious choice. Oh, the Toronto Maple Leafs. Conn Smythe purchased Toronto's hockey team. He's another trophy, Conn Smythe. He purchased Toronto's hockey team in 1927, and one of his first orders of business was renaming the team. The franchise that began play as the Arenas in 1917 changed its nickname to St. Patrick's in 1919 to attract Toronto's Irish population. Smythe eventually decided on Maple Leafs for a couple of possible reasons. Smythe fought in the Maple Leaf Regiment during World War I, and there was a former Toronto hockey team called the East Maple Leaves. I think the guy who wrote this is really grasping at straws myself. Yes. The Winnipeg Jets. The Winnipeg Jets formed in late 1971, got their moniker from a team of the same name that played in Canada's Western Hockey League. The current franchise is actually the second incarnation. The first relocated to Phoenix, Arizona in 1996 and became the Phoenix Coyotes. The current franchise was originally called the Atlanta Thrashers, named by Ted Turner, after Georgia's state bird, the Brown Thrasher, before it was sold to a Canadian group, True North Sports and Entertainment, in 2011 and relocated. Who followed that? Did anyone follow that? No, I didn't either. The Carolina Hurricanes. After the Hartford Whalers moved to Raleigh in 1997, new owner Peter Karmanos, Jr., named his team after the devastating storms that regularly ravaged the region. That I can believe. Okay. The Florida Panthers. Had Tampa Bay been awarded a baseball team in the early 90s, they likely would have been called the Florida Panthers, a reference to the endangered species of the same name. Instead, the nickname was adopted by Florida's second NHL team. When Panthers president Bill Torrey, former president of the New York Islanders, revealed the nickname, he told reporters, "A panther, for your information, is the quickest striking of all cats. Hopefully, that's how we will be on the ice." Exactly. Okay, we'll Tampa Bay Lightning. In 1990, a thunderstorm served as an inspiration for then-president of the Tampa Bay Hockey Group, Phil Esposito's decision to name his team the Lightning. Esposito said that in addition to being a natural characteristic of the Tampa Bay area, that and strip clubs, Lightning expressed the fast action of a hockey game. So it was either Lightning or Tampa Bay strip club. Either one. So he went with Lightning. Okay. Washington Capitals. Washington owner Abe Pollin decided on the perfectly apt nickname Capitals after staging a Name the Team contest. I think the Name the Team contest is the safest way to go with these names. Really is. Chicago Blackhawks, one of the original six. World War I veteran and coffee tycoon Frederick McLaughlin was Chicago's owner when it entered the NHL in 1926. McLaughlin named the team after the 86th Infantry Division in which he served. The Blackhawk Division was named after Chief Blackhawk of the Sauk American Indian Tribe who fought the Illinois Militia in 1832. The nickname was officially changed from Blackhawk to Blackhawks, eliminating the space in 1986. Well, we're going to take a break here, and we're going to bring in Bernie Nichols to lighten the moment right after this.
1240 WGBB Freeport.
Did you know that birthday parties help build confidence in kids?
Yeah. Did you know that giving kids less sugar before bedtime helps them sleep better?
Oh, totally. Did you know that friendly kids have more friends?
Everybody knows that.
Hey, guys, did you know that most people think they're using the right car seat for their kid, but they're not?
I didn't know that.
Parents who really know it all know for sure that their child is in the right car seat at the right age and size. Visit safercar.gov/the right seat to make sure your child is protected. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
At highway speeds, the average text takes your eyes off the road for about 5 seconds. That's enough time to travel the length of a football field. Stop texts. StopWrecks.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Job School Day students community. High 7 the classroom, 1,000 America attendance. Quit variety day of reasons. Job like to get. Baby raise a. Relative help an elderly. Happening local on it's a level. Catastrophe, it's a national.
7,000 high school students drop out every school day. It doesn't make sense to us either. We can keep students in school. Visit boostup.org and take the first step. Brought to you by the U.S. Army and the Ad Council.
I don't believe it. My savings are gone.
Okay, think. Where'd you have them last?
I was home, then I spent them on that vacation and this tiny suit of armor. Now they're gone.
Weird. Weird? Not really. Not saving now means no money later. Put away a few bucks, feel like a million bucks. For free ideas on ways to save, go to feedthepig.org. That's
feedthepig.org.
Oh, I broke his little gauntlet.
Oh, no.
This message brought to you by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and the Ad Council.
All right, we're back with Sports Talk 1240. We're going to bring in Bernie Nichols in a moment. My next guest, he scored 475 goals in his 17-year playing career for the Los Angeles Kings, the New York Rangers, the Edmonton Oilers, the New Jersey Devils, the Chicago Blackhawks, and the San Jose Sharks. He's been with us before. He's going to talk some hockey with us. Tell us about his new app. Is online now. 475 goals, 17-year playing career. The Kings, the Rangers, the Oilers, the Devils, the Blackhawks, the Sharks. He's been with us before. I welcome him back to the show. Our friend Bernie Nichols. Bernie, you with us?
I am. Thank you.
Good to have you with us, Bernie. How did it feel leaving Los Angeles and Gretzky to come to the Rangers?
Well, you know what? If I had to pick one place to go, New York was definitely a place. It was awesome. I think any time you get traded, it's hard. And then especially after playing a year with Gretz, I kind of wanted to play a few more years with him. So very difficult to be traded, but if I had to go to one place, New York was the spot. It was awesome playing in New York.
Well, you enjoyed it here, and you thought you found a home here. Then they ship you off to Edmonton for Messier. How'd you feel about that?
Well, same thing.
Yeah.
You know, you're playing, and you love where you're at, and all of a sudden you're gone again. So that was probably every bit as hard. I knew Mark was getting traded, really hoping that I have the opportunity to play with him. That would have been some guy that I would love to have played with. Obviously, it didn't happen, but I bumped heads with him many times. When I was in L.A., he was in Edmonton, and then when he was in New York, I was in New Jersey. So he's as good as it gets, and I would love to have played with him.
He turns out to be the missing piece of the puzzle for the Rangers.
Oh, for sure.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Now, recently we saw the banner being raised in L.A. The Kings got their rings. What do you think the chances are that they repeat, Bernie?
Well, you know what? L.A. has as complete team as there is in the league. I think it obviously starts with goaltending. Jonathan Quick, in my opinion, he's as good as any in the league, in the world, you know. So
he really showed that last spring. Yeah,
well,
that's
for sure. And the first year they won it, you know, like. So, and then you work your way out. Drew Doughty, if he doesn't, eventually win that defensive award, I don't know, because he's as good a defenseman as there is in the league. Anze Kopitar up front, Jeff Carter, they got Brown. They got just a real, real complete team. So they're built for a playoff. They're built for a playoff run. So, you know, it's like them and Chicago have been going at it for the last 3 years, and one would win, then the next one would win. They've each won two in a row. So, but great team, great playoff team, and if anybody could do it, they can do it.
Now, on the other side of the coin, you have King Henrik in that final series. And what do you think of the Rangers with the couple of changes they've made to the club? And that final series they had last spring as well.
Well, you know, they got great goaltending as well, and that gave them an opportunity to be in every series and win some as well, you know. So they start off great this year. They just had their home opener tonight, and the Kings been hit pretty hard. It was 4-1, so I decided to change it and watch a football game.
Not the Jets, I hope.
No.
No, okay.
No, the Giants and Philly. So, no, they got a good team, too. Nash is playing very well for them the way they expect him to. So they still got a good team. And like I said, when you got good goaltending, you got an opportunity to be in every game.
But you still like L.A.?
No, I do. I just think they're just so deep. They're a big, strong team. They can be physical. They've got a tremendous amount of skill. So, to me, the West is Chicago and L.A., and the East, it can be, you know, Pittsburgh, if they can ever get good goaltending, New York, because they got good goaltending, and then you could probably Boston is good. So I think the East is a little more open than the West.
Okay. Now, for some of the Islander fans out there, have you seen some of the changes they've made?
No, I have, and, I think they're going to be good this year, too. So, you know, I think they've built in the right direction. If their goaltender plays well, which he should, they get some guys that were hurt last year at the end of the season back. Tavares is, I think he's healthy now. I think even going to the Olympics, even though he got hurt and didn't necessarily play the whole thing, it was a good confidence booster for him. He's a leader. Great player, and hopefully their team will follow along with them.
We just can't believe it's the last year at the old Coliseum.
Well, it's about time, though. You know, that thing's well overdue. It's, they got a good team there. They need to be playing in a good building. That building should have been retired with Trotz and Boss and Pot Van, it should have went with them.
I think more people, Bernie, are just disappointed that they couldn't build a new one here.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And, like, what a great place to play.
That the politicians couldn't get together and build a new Coliseum on the same spot rather than have to move to Brooklyn.
Right.
That's the unfortunate thing. Well, Bernie, tell us about your new app.
Well, this thing's been in the works for a little while, but for the most part, it's a sports stock market app called ASM Free. It's a free app. You download it. You get ASM money. You get $2,500 of free money. So you buy and sell shares in sports teams. You build a portfolio, or sports folio, sorry. When your team wins, each shareholder gets paid out dividends. It's just like a stock. When your stock does well, your shareholders get paid dividends as well. So
Okay. It's
the first of its kind. No one's ever done this before. And it's not gambling. It's not like if your team loses, you lose your money. You know, it's an investment. You can put it in there. Like I said, when your team wins, you get paid dividends. It's most people want to have a share in their own team, kind of like the Packers. You know, Packers is the only publicly traded company there is, or sports team, and, you know, people have $100, $1,000 shares in the Packers, which is amazing. I can't imagine anybody in New York that wouldn't want to have a share of the Rangers, the Islanders, you know, the Giants or Jets.
Sure.
You know? So right now we have football and hockey. When basketball opens up, we'll go there, and then baseball. But the concept to me is awesome, and it's like, you know, you can play GM or you can play owner. If, say, for example, the Islanders they got a homestand and, they feel they're going to sweep all five games, you put some, buy some shares in the Islanders. You know, every win they get, you get paid a dividend. So the concept, good. Like I say, it's all free. I think sometimes I get people respond back, you know, don't want to spend the money or this or that, but it's free. They don't understand. It's asmfree.com. You just download it. You go on there and you go to teams, put in NFL or NHL. Teams come up. It has the shares right beside it. I think last time I looked, I think the Rangers are like $21.50-ish a share. I think the Islanders are somewhere down around 15 or something. So there's a good investment right there. Hopefully they're going to have a good year, so buy some shares in them.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Now, let people know where they could go get this again, Bernie.
You just download it. You just put in asmfree.com, and it will come up. It's a free download. It's a free app, and then you just sign up for free, and you're playing.
Bingo.
You know, and the concept is, it's kind of like if you've seen PokerStars.net. You can go in there, and you can play for free. But the concept with us is, once we get enough people and understand how to do it, then turn it into a real money app, and you know, then you can play it, and then you can really do investing. You can invest in your sports team, any sports teams. We have Snoop Dogg. We donate proceeds from this here to Snoop Dogg's youth kids football. So, you know, we're giving back, supporting the kids, which is great. It's a fun app. Like I say, it's not gambling, so you're not losing your money. But it's just like fantasy sports, too, where you can right now, where you're playing GM, you're going to buy teams, or you're an owner, you're going to buy shares in teams, and try to find the team that's getting on a winning streak, and you can make some money that way.
Great. Where'd you get this idea, Bernie?
Well, my cousin had actually asked me to get involved because they needed someone to do, open up some doors in the sports part. But there was a gentleman, Chris Rabelais, and Ace out of L.A., they've kind of come up with the concept. It's been in the makings a long time, but they've definitely got it right now. It's working great, smart. And for me, being a sports person, like I said, I don't know any sports person, men and women. I get a lot of L.A. Women from the Kings follow me. Like, my daughter's just a crazy Kings nut. You know,
uh-huh.
Fan, they love it, right? Because they feel like they're part of the L.A. Kings.
Sure, yeah.
Sharing the L.A. Kings. And When I went on the air in Chicago the other day, the Hawks, all the shares bought out. So now hopefully we can get all the Rangers and Islander shares to be bought out. Get to, because Rangers and, you know, New York got the best fans. They're unbelievable. So I know they'll all want to support their team, and hopefully they can go in there and buy shares in their favorite teams.
Sounds good. Give us the website again.
It's asmfree.com.
Okay, good.
Perfect.
Anything else you want to tell us, Bernie?
Nope. Hockey's back. Football's going. Baseball playoffs have been great. Sports are great right now.
How about the World Series? What are you thinking there?
Well, I can't believe the Royals.
Kansas City, right?
Yeah, unbelievable. But I'm cheering for them. You know, like, I met George Brett when I was playing with the Kings. He used to come to some games, so I know him a little bit, and I know he has a little something to do with the Royals right now.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what capacity, but who couldn't cheer for the Royals?
It's good to see a team like that.
Absolutely.
For sure.
Yeah, and I like to see San Francisco win, but, you know, you look at St. Louis, they're in every year.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. They can, you know, Pujols goes, somebody else goes, doesn't matter.
They're back.
They still win.
Yeah.
It's amazing. So, you know, how can you not cheer for them either?
All right. Bernie Nichols, always a pleasure. Keep in touch. Let us know how you're doing.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bernie Duffy. Nichols, folks. Thanks for joining me tonight. I'd like to thank my guests, Jay Paterno and Bernie Nichols, my engineer, Brian Graves, and you for joining us. Stay tuned for Hour 2 with Andrew Joseph. He's up next on Sports Talk 1240. I'll be back with you Sunday night, October 26th. Till then, Bill Donahue wishing you a good evening, folks.
Expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.